Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today's special guest is Dr. Jack Black. Jack is Professor of Culture, Media and Sport at Sheffield Hallam University. He teaches modules in philosophy, sociology and research methodologies. His research brings together psychoanalytic theory with cultural studies, with a particular focus on race, sport and popular culture. He is Senior Editor of Sport and Psychoanalysis and Associate Editor for International Journal of the Sociology of Leisure, Psychoanalysis, Culture and Society. Jack, you're very welcome to Edge Ideas. How are you today?
Hello, Simon. I'm good. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you. Good. It's the first time we've met.
Yes.
I picked up your paper on LinkedIn, thinking about Lacanian perspectives on AI and ChatGPT and those things, and it really engaged me. So that's what we're talking about today. Where would you like to begin thinking about AI and Lacan?
I suppose we can begin where it sort of began for me a bit, really. I'd sort of always had an interest in applying Lacan to sort of culture and the media. And in particular, I was doing a lot of research around online hate and digital media. And then obviously, I don't know how many years ago it would have been now, perhaps three or four, ChatGPT emerged. And I suppose for me, one of the things what I always love about Lacanian psychoanalysis is that it gives us a way of thinking about the human, about the subject. And obviously you have this artificial intelligence suddenly come out of what felt like almost nowhere. And for me, it posed some interesting questions about what makes us human.
Yeah.
And what makes the subject a subject, according to Lacan. So I suppose that's one of the ways in which, the initial ways I started to think through AI via Lacan. I'll be honest with you, it was an area of research I had no anticipation I would start. It was just from reading Lacan and then from reading around ChatGPT and the use of artificial intelligence, particularly sort of LLMs, the learned language machines, that I thought, actually, this is an interesting topic to explore some sort of key Lacanian ideas. So that's where it began for me.
Yeah, and that's interesting. As soon as ChatGPT and AI sort of came mainstream, I immediately kind of thought, this is really interesting, you know, because Lacan talks about the unconscious is structured like a language, and this is all about kind of the large language systems. And I immediately started thinking these are very interesting sort of connections. And just for the audience, you know, Jacques Lacan is a French psychoanalyst, very famous. He broke away from mainstream psychoanalytic kind of practices. He got thrown out of the IPA. He's very popular in South America, in France, and very influential beyond psychoanalysis. He's kind of used a lot in cultural and social studies. So that's where we start. Your paper positions AI as a relational kind of, I think that the introduction to your paper talked about kind of AI being relational. And I thought that immediately was interesting because people often think of it as an object, as a kind of cyborg, as a human, kind of object, which is not. Say something about it being relational, Jack.
Yeah. So I think there seems to be sort of what would you call them, like subtopics that are sort of emerging now in the study of AI and LLMs. One of the things we sort of found was there was lots of research and debate about whether or not the sort of AI could be called a subject, whether or not it had something like an unconscious, whether or not we were seeing the sort of the birth of artificial intelligence in the sort of full sense of that word. So that seemed to be one area of study. The second one is the sort of the wider sort of political, social, sort of economic ramifications of something such as AI. So the effects it'll have on jobs. We're already suggestions that it's being used in politics. I think there's been instances around the world where governments have created sort of documents and policies that when people have looked into it, the references aren't real, and there's suggestion that it's been written by ChatGPT. And I suppose one of the things what we wanted to do in this paper was really push its sort of relational aspects. Mm. And what we mean by that is not forgetting the fact that this machine is invented by humans. Yeah. And that actually it might say something more about us as subjects and as human beings than what it might say about itself being a subject or a human being. So this came from some of the research we were seeing out there was sort of questioning about whether or not AI had a subjectivity, whether or not AI had an unconscious. And for me and Jacob Johansson, who I did the paper with, you know, our answer to that was no, really. So then it was a process of why do we think that, and then working through that in that regard. And a key thing we took there was that you have to conceive of our relationship with AI as being inherently relational. It has to have this relational component to it. And that for me is sort of the beauty really of Lacan. Lacan isn't, well, some people might debate it, but I don't really consider him to be a psychological thinker. I think he's a great social theorist about the relationship between the subject and the wider social world and how the tensions and ambiguities of being a human being are actually reflected in and through our social relations. So for me, sort of marrying Lacan with this sort of study and that sort of relational focus was something that we wanted to push.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. I mean, I discuss quite often the difference between psychology and ego psychology and kind of like real psychoanalysis or Lacanian psychoanalysis, where, like you say, it's about the social field more. So it's about our, kind of our relationship to the together and yeah, to society around us. And I mean, that's what really interests me, because I first studied in a British object relations kind of way of thinking. And that's very kind of, it's relational, but it's also kind of deeply psychological. And it's a different way of thinking.
Well, that's why the O's in there. That's why it's psychoanalysis, because the O, Freud wanted the O to refer to the world. Otherwise, yeah, it would have just been psyche analysis and we'd just been analysing our psyche. So it's something I always like to point out, that there's an O in the middle of that world, which means we can take this sort of social perspective.
That's interesting. I've been around this field for years and years and years and no one's ever said that before.
Yeah, yeah. I stole it from someone. I can't remember who, so I'm going to claim it as my own now.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's good, and it's like really important, because when I studied at the Tavistock, I thought this, you know, this was missing. You know, they'd reach out a bit into society, but it's very kind of marginal, really. But it's kind of fundamental for me, and Lacan really opened that up. It kind of you immediately find yourself in the political world and in the social world and stuff. I mean, how relational kind of, I mean, I was thinking about Lacan's three registers, you know, the imaginary, the real, and the symbolic, and thinking about when we use ChatGPT, we kind of think about it as like an imaginary kind of scopic, really. You know, we kind of imagine it's something which it isn't.
Yeah.
And AI itself, it's almost like it works in a symbolic, in a sense. It's about language and stuff. So you've got these two kind of different kind of registers coming together.
Yeah, I think it's very good at tricking you, I think, AI, because it, you know, I've written elsewhere about how one way in which we can distinguish the subject from AI is in the way in which it lies. So AI lies, but it doesn't lie, in my opinion, like a subject does. And sort of one of the tricks it sort of plays on you is that just how good it is at that sort of basic conversational level. I mean, any of us, you know, both of us could load up ChatGPT on our laptops and, you know, literally have a conversation until we want to stop. And obviously it is being used like that in certain respects by numerous people around the world. You're hearing stories, aren't you, about people using it as a form of therapy, you know, people asking it for certain opinions on stuff. And again, the trick there is how it talks to us. It talks to us in that sort of very communicative model there. And that, again, this is why Lacan is interesting, because obviously, language, the symbolic order, our relationship to the big other are all key Lacanian concepts, which we can actually use to actually just pick that apart a little bit and see what is actually going on in our relationship with something such as AI and ChatGPT. It's very easy, as I say, to get trapped in that sort of imaginary relationship where you think you're talking to somebody in that respect. But obviously, we need to remember that the way in which these models work is they're not thinking, or at least they're not thinking like subjects do. It might be another form of thinking, you could make the argument, it might be a form of thinking that is beyond our own capacity to even think about how it thinks, because we think in such a particular way as human subjects. So again, I think that's another interesting debate there that could be had around AI.
Yeah. And, you know, we're hearing about like these large language models might not be here for too long. There might be other ways of thinking. So there might be, you know, we're hearing that this might have its limitations, and some AI thinkers are saying like actually there's a much better way and thinks in a completely different way, you know. So we're yet about that.
Yeah. I think that's what I was reading some of the day. I can't remember what it's called, but because it's trained on language, there's this idea that it's actually getting worse because it's there's now so much sort of AI or sort of ChatGPT language out there that actually it's getting fed its own language back to itself, and it's going to get progressively worse in that regard, which again I think is interesting. That's because I think what that does, at least that reminds us that these things are sort of, you know, computational models where it's not thinking. What it's trying to do is it's trying to work out the next best word to finish the sentence of what you said type thing. I always say the example to think, you know, if you asked it, you know, what color is the sky? It doesn't know that the answer is blue. It doesn't have that knowledge built into it. It just knows from the models it's been trained on that the response with the best probability to be correct or to actually say that is blue. So it knows from previous responses and the way it's been trained that blue is statistically a better answer than saying it's green, which is why we get into this interesting world of sort of the hallucinations and the mistakes and the inaccuracies, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. I was interested in your thinking on discourses, and I want to pull that apart a bit about how you think the Lacan has the four discourses.
Mm-hmm.
Say something about that, because I that challenged me a bit, and I think that through with you.
Yeah, so I think, you know, something like discourse, my background was more in sociology. So as soon as I start to think of discourse, I tend to think of a thinker such as Foucault.
Yeah.
And to a certain respect, you can see a similarity in the way in which the two thinkers are using the term discourse. Yeah. Whereas Foucault, it's you know, it's linked to relationships of power. For Lacan, it's got, I would say, a far more structural aspect to it, in the sense that he's talking about your relationship in relation to master signifiers, the other, and what he often refers to, as the objet pedior. So the object R in that regard. And that's, so you're talking about a relationship not just to the subject with other subjects, but also relationships to itself, as well as to forms of authority in the case of the master signifiers and the form of the other. So I've always enjoyed it, because for me, it gives you that sort of, immediately you can start seeing, if we're talking in that sort of structural sense, we're talking here about the sort of relationships that people have both to themselves, but also to other human beings. So there's two discourses we looked at in the paper, and the two of them were the discourse of the aesthetic and the discourse of the analysis. Now, typically in Lacan's model, the discourse of the aesthetic is usually tied to this idea of challenging authority, or a sense of doubt, at least.
Yeah.
So the other might say you're a particular thing, and the aesthetic says, "Why am I that? You know, why am I that for the other? Why, you know, why am I, for instance, labeled that particular way? Why am I given that particular name?" And what we found actually in this, we found this in a lot, both within research, but also in some quite contemporary examples, is that we tend to sort of fall into this hysterical relationship with AI. We ask it particular questions. We try to, try to get particular responses out of it in a particular way. You know, okay, you think this, but why do you think that? What does that mean? So we were talking there about how this sort of discourse or the hysteric, therefore, is reflected in that. Again, this is quite interesting because we're still referring to it as an other here, as what Lacan refers to as a subject supposed to know.
Yeah.
So this idea that some entity with the knowledge that it can then endow upon us and give it, and, you know, give us this knowledge to us. Yeah. So that's one way in which we started to explore the discourse of the aesthetic. Does that make sense?
Well, I question it. I mean, let me try to push back on that. I mean, for me, I go to the discourse of the master because I'm thinking, yeah, the one who's supposed to know. And like, maybe academics like you question it, but maybe most people don't. Maybe most people kind of take it as you know, they go to it thinking it's the master, it's the one who's supposed to know, and actually treating it like that. Or even the discourse of the university, you know, this huge bank of knowledge, like, you know, so these two are quite close. Like ChatGPT will tell me what I need to know, you know, whether it's kind of some life skills or whether it's kind of something about Lacanian psychoanalysis. It knows, you know, so that, you know, that's where I go with it.
Yeah. And I think one thing we can sort of, I think what comes out of what you've just said really is how the models can be applied to it in various different ways. I think this is one thing to always bear in mind with Lacan. And again, my sort of background isn't clinically, it's cultural. These cultural applications,
yeah,
of Lacan.
Yeah.
And you know, I think if you look at, for instance, you know, his writing on the perverse structures, psychotic structures, hysteric structures, people get stuck in these structures, and obviously they can be clinically diagnosed as being psychotic.
Yeah.
But what I've always thought Lacan's saying is actually we move about these positions in relationship, in change, and that's how our lives change in relationship to different others, and as well as to our own personal circumstances and the social circumstances we find ourselves in. So I would argue, I mean, everything you were saying there, I wouldn't disagree with. I do think we turn to the subject, sorry, to the AI and to ChatGPT as this subject supposed to know. What I think is quite interesting there is I've written elsewhere that actually I don't necessarily think we look for knowledge in it. I think that, you know, Lacan famously said that if anything, the subject is ignorant of its own knowledge. It's one of the reasons why it ends up in psychoanalysis. So I actually think that what AI is quite good is what it does is it allows us to actually become subjects of desire to a certain respect. And this is the way in which this hysterical discourse begins to come out. We very rarely do I think, you know, even if it was to give us knowledge, I think we're still very quick to challenge it. And I think if you look at the way in which people have, or the use of AI, I think when it first came out, it was almost seen as like a quite incredible Google. You know what I mean? Rather than getting the millions of responses, you know, I want a recipe for, I don't know, making roast potatoes. And it would give you like something quite specific. But I actually find now, and from speaking to people, that actually they now sort of, they don't really take that as a response anymore. It's almost like, okay, yeah, but I want this more. Okay, or why are you saying that? I want this as part of it. Oh, no, I don't want those options. I now want these options. Yeah. And I think that's one way in which the way it's been set up is obviously to encourage, I think, that. Obviously, it needs us to continue to use it because it's learning off us. So I do think there's this hysterical component there, which is quite interesting. And someone like Slavoj Žižek would argue, you know, the hysterics position is where we should be arguing from. It's where ideological critique begins because it allows us to begin to question these ideological forces.
Yeah. No, I think it's where it should come from and probably where some people go with it for sure. But it also, like, for me, it's part of this kind of wider consumerism kind of, it's part of the, you know, it does create a desiring subject. It does kind of, it's very seductive. It kind of, it treats you very politely and kind of asks you, could it be very helpful? And it kind of seduces you into kind of being your best friend. And you know, you go there and you become a desiring subject for more knowledge. So you kind of want more of it and more of it and more of it, which is what it wants. You know, it wants you to spend more time on it and engage with it.
And it comes across as that thinking being, you know, I caught a student once using it to help them in their writing, but in the sense of like they were writing and then they were uploading it and getting it to give him like, what did it think about what it was writing? And obviously what it was getting back was, you know, you're writing terrific, this is wonderful, great examples. And actually I was having to say, no, they're actually wrong, some of these. So it's not giving you correct, you know what I mean, information in that regards. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, one thing we talk about in the paper a bit is moving it more towards this discourse, the analysis, which is slightly different, I think, compared to the other ones.
Yeah, and that surprised me as well, because I mean, I you know, that takes me into kind of, you know, the psychoanalytic position of, you know, I mean, I still go and have Lacanian analysis. I'm still on the couch and I you know, you have the analyst position kind of clearly there. But yeah, say some more about how that operates with AI, how you think that operates with AI, because that interested me.
So it's one of those, I mean, one thing, I think it's very difficult, you know, when me and Jacob were writing this and when I've been thinking about this in the wider scope, I think it's, you know, it's far too easy just to be like, you know, don't use it. You know, it's Eve, because it's kind of here. So we may as well study it. At least, you know, at least we can make sure we get the, you know, right path in studying it, which is why Lacan is useful. But for me, the discourse of the analysis for Lacan is the position which the analyst has with the analyzer. So the patient, the person undergoing psychoanalysis. And really, there's a process of transference. Originally, when you go into analysis, you perceive the analyst as the subject supposed to know. So very similar to how you would relate there to the ChatGPT. They're the ones with the knowledge who can solve whatever problems you're having or what you're going through. But what Lacan talks about is actually there's a change that goes through where you begin to realize actually that the analyst doesn't have the answers at all. Mm. And actually, their desire is as enigmatic and as opaque as your own. And then actually it's through realizing that there's this gap in the analysis, this gap in the other, that your forms of authority are inherently lacking beings, that you begin to sort of go through this process of actually, you know, I would argue accepting subjective destitution, acknowledging lack. So I do think actually there's something there that can be held with regards to the limits in knowledge of the analysis and the limits in the knowledge that ChatGPT has. In fact, you know, I wouldn't necessarily, to me, I would argue you would come to realize it isn't knowledge in the typical way in which we approach knowledge or conceive of knowledge as human beings. So I think that's one way of sort of using these things, using these discourses as a way of sort of pointing to the limits and sort of the lack of consciousness that is there.
Yeah, like, you know, from my own experience, you know, you very quickly get excited by this amazing machine, which kind of just, you know, pours out stuff and like, wow, you know, when you first use it, it is really wow. And like, it's still, there's still some incredible kind of, advances from kind of what we knew before about how things work. But yeah, you very quickly you start feeling kind of the lack. You start feeling, okay, it doesn't quite live up to its promise. It does make mistakes, you know, and only can serve in a limited way. And if you start to learn how it can serve you in that limited way, that's okay. But there's definitely kind of the lack there for sure. And yet on the other hand, the AI kind of, the billions and billions and billions of kind of dollars being thrown at this is because it's seen as a commercial advancement, basically. It's like, you know, so it's invested in kind of covering over the lack, a bit like consumers. And so it becomes like an object petty AI itself. It's there to cover over the lack, and critical thinkers like me and you will expose the lack. But for the majority of consumers, it's like going to the shopping mall and just kind of like, sucked into it.
Yeah, allows us to think about things around the way in which disavowal works, of the notion of fascistic disavowal. So I know very well, but nevertheless, we know very well we're talking to a machine and it's not a real person, yet nevertheless,
yeah,
it's actually sometimes just quite nice not to think that. So I can see that sort of link there that you're sort of building with capitalism. And again, I think the main drive there is the sort of data perhaps it's collecting about us rather than actually anything else.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things I'm finding is in my field of, I've changed fields, but I used to be in psychotherapy. I'm still in executive coaching and coaching world. I write about coaching, and there's real kind of anxiety about it. Like, it's real sort of, and kind of the underlying discourse the coaches have and counselors have is it kind of stealing our jobs kind of thing? And is it going to, they talk against it as it can't ever be as good as us real humans.
Yeah.
They like compare it to themselves. And I think what's interested in me in that is psychologists and some counselors and some coach training, fundamentally, I think they get trained almost to be like AI operatives themselves. So they get trained to kind of ask certain questions in certain ways. And I think they're the ones who feel threatened by it, whereas someone like myself, who's a psychoanalyst, I'm not threatened at all by it because it's different. It's something else.
Definitely. It's almost like a return of the press there, isn't it?
Yeah,
that what they're getting back is exactly what they've been doing now. Got it in a sort of an objective form. No, definitely. I mean, this is one conclusion I completely steal from Slavoj Žižek, who says the biggest fear about AI is that we actually start to talk and like AI, that actually we begin to mimic the way it speaks, that lack of ambiguity, that sort of lack of nuance that it tends to have. It's why I think in another paper, I explore the relationship with ChatGPT through lying, because I think that says something quite interesting about how it functions and the way in which language works.
Yeah.
And therefore something interesting about the unconscious. But it's losing that complexity. It doesn't have the gap or the lack that subjects have, according to Lacan.
Yeah.
So it's almost, that's, again, this is kind of beautiful. And I know, I know Lacan, particularly in his early seminars, was very much into sort of cybernetics and the way in which computers were being used to replicate language and stuff. Now, I do think a lot of his ideas can sort of, can be used and applied in this context, almost like he was made for it, really,
yeah.
I think.
No, I agree. I think, I think about language and society, the big other kind of, it's all there, isn't it? It's all kind of a...
Yeah,
very, very much kind of in your face. You before you jumped into the AI game, you're clearly writing a lot about race, about culture, and stuff. Where do you think that fits into kind of the AI picture when you take those perspectives?
Good question. Honestly, my honest answer is I haven't got a clue yet. This is something I'm actually trying to work through and think on, actually. There are, obviously, there's been numerous examples now where actually AI has just repeated sort of racist responses.
Yeah.
and other comments and through the responses it's given. My previous, as I said, one of my books, The Psychosis of Race, applied Lacan's psychotic structure to the ways in which we can approach race and conceive of race and well see the effects of racism. So I have been thinking, I'm writing a little bit on the moment about hallucinations, AI hallucinations. So when an AI deliberately gives incorrect information. So I'm thinking at the minute about the psychotic relationship that we have to AI. And again, it's us, I think, that has that relationship with AI. AI is not psychotic. I think we can have these sort of perverse or psychotic relationships to it. So I have thought there about whether or not there's connections to be made between what I've referred to as the psychosis of race and then obviously the way in which we may deal with ChatGPT through a psychotic structure. And I think there's examples now of people having full-on psychotic breaks through talking to AI. They believe it's giving it special information. They're being told special information and it's telling them to do particular things. Again, I do think our relationship to it is inherently perverse. So I think it's one way in which you can look at those two. But sport, and as I said, a lot of my other research focuses a lot on sport and culture and society. And I think there's interesting ways there in which I was speaking to somebody actually on Friday who is looking at it in relation to sort of golfs and the way in which you can simulate golf swings through the use of AI. But again, to me, I'm trying to think through that, move away a little bit from that sort of practical element, I suppose, which I think is how it's being applied there. Which again is interesting because I think it's, you know, we're using AI to solve problems, forgetting that actually in the sense that it's something beyond our problems. It's, you know, it's created by humans. So my first reaction is it's going to create and the same problems we have as humans, which I think gets forgotten again in these sort of practical applications. You know, we might be putting kerosene on a fire, so to speak, if you're trying to use it to solve a problem rather than actually, yeah.
And do you think in terms of when we think about the big other, we think about, you know, it can be thought about in different ways, but, you know, we think about kind of society's voice in our superego. We think about kind of what shapes us. Do you think the AI shifts anything in society's position of the big other?
Oh, that's good. Another good question. I think it makes. I mean, if we think of the big other as, you know, this symbolic entity, this sort of form of authority, I think it objectifies that. I think that's one thing technology has done is it's objectified the big other in something, you know, or relatively literal, you know, at least in a form of technology which I can access via my phone or via a laptop. So in many respects, I suppose we're having a direct relationship with an assumed other in that regard, which is quite interesting. You know, that wouldn't have been available to us 10 or 20 years ago. I think, for instance, if we, you know, to take a sporting example there, this might be a connection in, you know, similar to what I was just referring to there in using sport is, you know, we use a range of technologies which tell us what's going on inside of us. So our heart rate, you know, our blood levels, all these sort of forms of technology which now get used as part of sporting participation, which are sort of, I always think of them as these sort of inhuman technologies because they're saying literally what's in the human, but doing it in such a way where I can never see or I can never really know if it's true or not. It's just numbers which I rely upon. So I do think it's done that. I think it's definitely objectified the other or made it literal in that regard. And the whole point, you know, Lacan's whole point is, you know, there is no other of the other. The other is a lacking, inherently lacking being. It's only got its authority because all of us collectively view it with that authority. So again, it's not something that is inherently innate to it, but it's something that's always there. And I think, you know, acknowledging that sort of relationship to the other as one grounded in ambivalence and ambiguity is kind of what Lacan's getting at over the process of.
Yeah, and it probably builds on Zizek's earlier work. You know, he talked about kind of we don't have any ideologies, not about kind of a big communist kind of big other or a big dictator big other like it was. It's lots of little others now. And it probably kind of builds on that and amplifies that, doesn't it? That, you know, like you say, it's very accessible. It's with it, you know, it's there, but it's kind of individualized. And you know, you go onto your phone for it, you go onto your computer, you have kind of that personal relationship with it in a different way than you did for kind of an oppressive big other.
Yeah, definitely. Perhaps more so than any other domain, I'd argue, is that this is, you know, I do think education is going to be one of the arenas where this is going to be fought for, if that makes sense, or at least that type of understanding of, at least the way the approach to AI that we're sort of perhaps talking about here needs to be made apparent, because I just worry, particularly the ways in which universities are now starting to integrate AI into, for instance, student assessments.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's kind of being used in that sort of that knowledgeable, oh, this thing will fix the problems. Which I think I think those things need to be fought. I mean, there's a set of rules that my university's come up with regarding how to use AI, and I always say like 2/3 of them just aren't needed, because they're just, you're sort of taking just the naturalness of thinking away from the student, which I find really, really odd. So I do think education is going to be one area where at least we can make, you know, we'll probably lose it in banking, and obviously education, particularly, you know, neoliberal universities and all that, we're under pressures in far other ways. But I do think this is one area where we can perhaps fight against this, what I think will just become more predominant.
Yeah, and it does ask questions about, you know, education's synthesizes this question really about what is thinking, you know, what does it mean to think, to be a thinking human, what does it mean to be desiring human, all those questions. It really does raise them and make them quite stark. I mean, I work in the corporate world quite a bit as a coach and stuff, and you know, that they can't adopt AI fast enough, and all they got in mind is efficiencies, you know. So
yeah.
You know, and it says, so, you know, it's metrics, efficiencies. It's kind of this amplifying kind of that way of thinking, which is bad enough already. Like, you know, now it's you become a quantified self and all this, you know. But, you know, where thinking and kind of the contemplative and the reflective and the lack, you know, come into that in education, you know,
definitely
big questions. Yeah,
I mean, it's the examples you just give is thinking to overcome failure rather than thinking through failure. I mean, you know, it's always, and you might have had similar experiences, you know, with your own students, but it, you know, the students who I've taught who have, you know, been undergrad and then gone on to postgrad and then gone on to PhD, you know, it's amazing how they've thought and they've learned through failure. I try to explain to students, look, sometimes not understanding something is actually the best way you actually eventually begin to pull it apart and get a better understanding of it. Thinking isn't this success. You know, you don't go, you know, you weren't taught something and then suddenly it went in your brain and that's it. You had knowledge of it. You repeat it in an assessment, and it's all well and good. I mean, we do have some students do this. I think this is quite an interesting way. You know, I always think student assessments are essentially, what I'm asking them to do is for them to read my desire in a way that actually they can never actually meet. The student who does everything I tell them to do, there is immediately weird, and it doesn't feel right. It's wrong. And what I mean by that is they're usually wrong. They're usually not understanding it, what you're trying to teach, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas it's always the student who goes against reading that desire, I think, is the one who's actually understanding the process of learning. And yeah, I just worry AI is just going to make that far more complicated and far more difficult.
I think that's right. I think it amplifies kind of different ways of being, and that's what, you know, a way of being is like, yeah, the idea that, you know, the corporate world, you know, get more knowledge as quick as you can, be as efficient as quick as you can, quantify it as much as you can, like, you know, so these kind of you know, discourses which are already there, they're human discourses, but they're kind of just amplified by this new topic called AI, like, for sure.
Definitely. And that's how it'll find its way into sport. You know, that another industry that is, you know, everything needs to get faster, everything needs to get quicker.
Yeah.
Tactics need to become more and more complicated in order to trick, you know. So yeah. I mean, that's one way in which it will probably find its expression.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, we're coming towards an end. Think about lack. What have we lacked in this conversation? Anything which you think which is important, which that you haven't kind of said?
Well, I'm trying to think. I mean, one of the points I would just like to make is I think the key thing now with looking where this sort of research goes is now, I think there's been lots of great stuff written about, you know, does it have subjectivity? Does it have unconscious? I mean, my sort of position on that is no, it doesn't. But I think making those links to sort of the real social political tensions that it's starting to sort of shed light on. I mean, essentially we've got, you know, large parts of our daily lives now on a sort of geopolitical scale is going to be run and administered through AI, whether that be from, you know, working out whether or not you get a mortgage to the student's assessment you're marking to the bombing of some place, which has been calculated according to AI, the information given by AI. So I think a key bit now, particularly and with moving some of these ideas forward, is looking at those sort of social political tensions. You know, I think there's some fantastic writing, sort of political writing, which draws upon Lacan, which I think might be quite useful here in highlighting those tensions.
Well, maybe you could share that with me and I'll share it with the audience after. Anything you can think of, you know, which would be kind of useful in this. It'd be really great to have a bit more readings. So that'd be fabulous. Thanks, Jack. One thing I ask all guests at the end of a podcast is, with their studies in whatever area they're in, anything which can help the audience think about what it means to live a good life and create a good society. So thinking about kind of AI, anything which contributes anything at all. I mean, these are kind of huge questions, but
yeah. I don't know. I hate these sort of questions because I always feel a little bit inherently pessimistic. So like the good. Anybody who thinks they're on the path to seeking the good life is probably going to leave nothing but destruction in their wake. But yeah, I think we might just be muddling along on this planet, and AI is just another complication that we're going to come across. I mean, what would I say? I mean, I would, you know, encourage anybody to engage with Lacan, perhaps. You know, I get a lot of, you know, hope out of reading this literature, and it allows me to approach things slightly differently. And you know, there's some great introductory texts now on Lacan. I mean, he's an incredibly difficult writer. Almost everything wasn't written. It was spoken, and so it was written afterwards.
Yeah.
So it comes across as, you know, it could be quite confusing a lot of the time, but there's some great now introductory texts. And yeah, I'd encourage anybody to sort of engage with those ideas if that's what they're looking for.
Yeah, no, I think that's very helpful. And, you know, we're not looking for some positive kind of world solution here. We're just, a critical edge. But I think, you know, what you said during this podcast around kind of the notion of lack, how important it is and stuff is just really, really important. So
yeah,
really, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you for sharing your thoughts.
No, that's great. Thank you very much.
Take care.